Aganaw, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Julie Aganaw. I'm an assistant counsel for discipline for the relator, counsel for discipline, I'm sorry, in the matter of the state ex-rel counsel for discipline versus Kent J. Tremblay. We're here on an original disciplinary action. In the matter, the underlying facts are that Mr. Tremblay was convicted in the U.S. District Court for the District of Nebraska of filing a false tax return in 2006. Specifically, he neglected to report gross receipts in excess of $1.1 million related to his veterinary and his legal practice and other businesses. Per his conviction, he was sentenced to 2 years probation with 6 months of house confinement and restitution. It's my understanding as of today, Mr. Tremblay has paid his restitution, he has served all the terms of his probation, and completed his house confinement. The formal charges that were filed allege that Mr. Tremblay violated sections A, B, and C of 3-508.4 plus his oath of office as an attorney. Mr. Tremblay filed an answer where he did not deny any of the allegations and raise no issues of material fact or law, and thus a motion for judgment of the pleadings was filed and granted. A brief hearing was held on the matter of sanctions alone. Many letters of support were provided on Mr. Tremblay's behalf. And at the conclusion of the hearing, the referee wrote a report recommending an 18-month suspension of Mr. Tremblay's law license. Neither the relator nor the respondent filed exceptions to that recommendation. And I'm here today to submit that the 18-month suspension, I believe, is within the range of what this court has done for similar action. When looking at specific cases, obviously I know this court looks at aggravating and mitigating factors. Mr. Tremblay has many mitigating factors, which I know are in the record. He's had no prior discipline. There was not any client harm involved. He's paid his restitution, and he's been very cooperative with the Council for Discipline from the very beginning of this matter. So I want to make sure that that's known. But when looking at the range of what this court has done, you have the case of Walls, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, who was disbarred after she was convicted of a felony of making terroristic threats. In that case, this court noted that there's not a bright line rule that every felony conviction equals disbarment, but based upon her conviction, this court found that disbarment was appropriate because her conviction reflected adversely on her fitness to practice. Another case where an individual was disbarred was Watkins, who actually submitted a voluntary surrender and the court accepted it, that he had pled guilty to a felony offense of filing a false tax return also. On that case, this court, there isn't a lot of discussion in the opinion because he submitted a voluntary surrender, so I'm not sure if this court would have found disbarment based upon the facts or not, but historically looking at that. And then
is that the case most factually similar to this?
Probably, yes. Then the other case that that was under the original code, and it involved moral turpitude, whereas the rules of professional conduct don't specifically address moral turpitude. It is addressed in the comments that moral turpitude more would be reflected on when we look at if their actions reflect adversely on their fitness to practice. So probably factually, yes. But I would submit that Mr. Tremblay has paid his restitution to the court and has been very cooperative, all the mitigating factors I listed. On the other hand, Scott was a case where Scott also pled guilty to filing a false tax return. And initially, this one looked very factually similar until you look at the history of Scott. Scott actually had been disciplined previously and was suspended for 1 year at the time of the filing false tax return, the formal charges against that. And in Scott had failed to pay his restitution to the court for a 10-year period up until he applied for reinstatement. He still hadn't paid, where Mr. Tremblay arguably has paid that and has come further along with that. But Scott also was disbarred based upon a voluntary surrender.
Does it matter what comes first, the admission of the problem or the act or the conviction of the felony, or is it how we treated those issues?
Well, under the rules, It says that if a case, like charges have been dismissed, criminal charges have been dismissed, it doesn't mean that the disciplinary action is automatically dismissed. We still look at the conduct, but the rules provide that with the conviction, that's proof of the conviction and all we have to look, or of the violation, and all we have to look at that point in time are the sanctions.
So in Scott, did the disciplinary action happen and then the conviction happened later?
I believe that he had his first disciplinary action for lying to the court, and he was suspended for a year. And then the time period during that, then he was convicted of the filing of the false tax return, and then additional formal charges were filed against him, and he filed a voluntary surrender, if I recall correctly. Other cases this court has looked at would be Tibbles, Hahn, and Ducek. All of them were suspended for 1 year for failing to file a false tax return. Whereas I would argue that Tremblay would need a more stringent sanction than just a year suspension, because he made affirmative representations in his filing to the federal government as opposed to failing to file a false tax return. Excuse me. Any further questions?
I think your argument expresses the concept, but I want you to put it, see if you agree expressly that the false statement in filing a false tax return is the distinction that's significant for our disciplinary purposes versus simply not filing a tax return at
all.
That
is correct.
Don't false statements go to the heart of the being an officer of this court?
I believe it does, yes. And I think this court has looked at various false statements, be it to a court or to a federal government with a filing in a grand jury testimony or something like that. In this case, it wasn't the only relation to his law practice was money he earned to his law practice. It didn't involve client funds or anything like that. But yes, you're right. I believe that lying deserves a higher sanction or warrants a higher sanction than, say, failing to file a form.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we would ask that the court affirm the referee's recommendation for an 18-month suspension of Mr. Tremblay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mock, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Clarence Mock, and I appear on behalf of Kent Tremblay to request that you accept the recommendation of the referee and impose a discipline of 18-month suspension in this particular matter. Mr. Tremblay has accepted responsibility for his transgression that occurred over 10 years ago, and it's an isolated blemish on an otherwise pristine disciplinary history for this attorney who practiced for over 23 years today. As you know, and Counsel for Discipline has informed you, Mr. Tremblay has complied with all the terms of his probation. There was nothing about the probation that interfered with his ability to practice law. He's continued to practice law during the interim without incident. And there is really nothing, given his cooperation with the court, with the Counsel for Discipline, and the testimony, as you've read in the record, related to those people who know him well and his community, to indicate that he would ever reoffend in this particular circumstance ever again. And so I think this court knows that there's no statute that governs any particular disciplinary sanction related to any particular conduct. Nebraska never has had that, to my knowledge. There is one statute that indicates that you can impose the sanction, but that's about it. And this court has always concentrated simply on the conduct as much as anything else. And 3320 capital B, as Counsel for Discipline alluded to, says that the fact that there's an acquittal doesn't terminate any kind of a disciplinary action or sanction. And there's just simply no bright line rule. And so when you look at the facts of this case and you look at what the statute is that's been violated, this is, in fact, a perjury statute. And the federal courts have construed it that way. It's a perjury statute that usually is accompanied by a failure to pay the tax, but when the federal courts have construed the statute, they look at it as mainly a perjury statute. Now, this court has imposed sanctions in perjury related cases before, and I would ask you to look at Cook as one. But the court has also looked at cases that I think are also false statement cases, which I have characterized in the brief, as you know, as false swearing cases. If you look at the Rokar case, so it's false swearing, filing false documents. If you look at the Douglas case, Fitch case, filing false financial documents, there are a number of cases that has occurred in which the suspension really has been as low as 6 months and as high as 3 years. And if you wanted to look at the average, it's right around about 1 year for that type of conduct, given that there are normal mitigating factors involved, such as acceptance of responsibility, lack of any criminal sanction imposed that involved incarceration and interfered with the ability to practice.
Does the amount of money involved, failure to pay, have anything to do with this?
Well, I think it's a factor, Your Honor. If you look at the second Scott case, there was $300,000 to $400,000 that was the amount that was apparently an issue. And here we're talking about less than a third of that. And secondly, in that case, there was absolutely no attempt whatsoever for Scott to pay any restitution related to that particular transgression, which was the failure to file over 10 years of tax returns. And as Counsel for Discipline pointed out, in Scott, he had previously been disciplined for 1 year suspension for lying to the court, and he received a prison sentence on top of it. And Tremblay, on the other hand, has indicated from the very beginning of the prosecution in this case of cooperation with the federal authorities and also with the disciplinary authorities, and he's done everything he could do to rectify his transgression in this case.
Is it relevant to, we have, as you say, no schedule of penalties. Is it relevant when we consider discipline what the sanction was in the criminal proceeding or the court proceeding?
I think it should be just something that should be considered, in the sense that when you look at whether or not a certain level of sanction should be imposed for disciplinary purposes, this court has said often that the purpose of discipline is not so much to punish the lawyer, but to determine whether or not they should continue to be allowed to practice law. And so the punishment has already been suffered in this particular case by Kent Tremblay. And so in one sense, when you look at what that punishment was, it's indicative, at least from the federal court's perspective, that Mr. Tremblay was a person who was a suitable candidate for probation, which would indicate that he was not likely to reoffend, that he had the kind of moral character and that would allow him to go forward and lead a law-abiding life, subject to serving out the terms of that probation, part of which was the payment of restitution, which he has accomplished, and as Counsel for Discipline has informed you, that he has complied with all aspects of that. So in that sense, I think it is somewhat of a consideration for that reason. Also, secondly, if you look at Scott, and you look at Walls, and you look at these cases where you talk about the convictions for malum in se criminal offenses, such as crimes of violence, or crimes of some sort of exceptional moral depravity, which I don't believe that failure to file a correct tax return amounts to, it makes a difference whether or not you go to jail in a particular case, because that interferes with your ability to practice law.
Do we also look at deterrence or reputation of the bar, things of those nature?
Sure. And you know, Your Honor, if you look at the Mills case, for example, and I concede that the Mills case is somewhat of a procedural abnormality, that it's a part of maybe the disposition in that particular case, but the conduct in that particular case, far worse than what happened in this particular case. In Mills,
contrary, if we heard in Mills and being too lenient, why should that induce us to continue the error today?
Your Honor, I'm not willing to concede you did err in Mills, and that Mills was not correctly decided on the basis of the record that was before at that time. And my understanding has always been that when this court takes a look at what's the appropriate sanction, you compare similar types of conduct and to arrive at an equitable result. And I don't think Mills was incorrectly decided. A 2-year suspension for that conduct was totally appropriate. Some people would say maybe it could be more, some might say less. But the court imposed 2 years, and in that particular case, not only was there lying to the IRS, false documents were created. A client was enlisted in the conspiracy to commit estate tax fraud. And, of course, then the attorney pled guilty to estate tax fraud, received probation, and is practicing law today. And I dare say that while there might be some who might disagree with that decision, it has not impeded the reputation of the bar, and it certainly has served as a deterrent for those who would engage in similar conduct. A 2-year suspension is a hefty suspension. A 2-year suspension is a kind of suspension that will seriously interfere with an attorney's ability to not only earn a living, but interferes with their earning capacity going forward. So it is in that sense that I say to you that the 18-month suspension in this particular case is appropriate. I think the referee was correct in the referee's analysis, and I would ask that you abide by that recommendation and suspend Kent Trembling for 18 months as recommended.
When the Nebraska Supreme Court integrated the bar in 1937, one of the things the opinion spoke about was not just the reputation of individual lawyers, but the reputation of other lawyers, and that by tolerating behavior that did not meet the applicable standards, all other lawyers suffered by their reputation. It's not hard for me to imagine sitting around a cafe somewhere in Nebraska and hearing, oh, there's a lawyer that pled guilty and was of a felony in federal court for filing a false tax return, and he's still practicing law. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond to that by saying this, that the quality of justice is not simply in punishment and exclusion when it comes to professional discipline. The quality of justice and professional discipline takes a look at all of the factors, and while it may be that the conduct has attached to it a particular level of criminal sanction, that, by the way, is simply a serendipitous exercise of discretion by prosecutors to determine whether or not particular conduct is described as misdemeanor or felony. And this court has never
prosecutors, is it? Pardon me? Oh, that's not just the prosecutor's discretion. A judge or a jury finds someone guilty of doing that.
Well, Your Honor, I know you were a former prosecutor, I was a former prosecutor, but I think that the buck starts with the decision by the prosecutor to...
It may start there, but it doesn't stop there.
Well, if the judge in a federal court, for example, has the ability to change the charge, and so if the prosecutor in this particular case had decided to charge it as a misdemeanor, it'd be a misdemeanor. And there's nobody other than the federal prosecutor who would have the authority to do that up and down the line in DOJ. And it's the same way on the state level. And so I don't think this court has ever, and in fact, 3320B would have no meaning if we simply punished on the basis of a prosecutor's characterization of the conduct as a felony or a misdemeanor. I mean, I don't want to...
So is your argument here that your client should have been charged with a misdemeanor?
No, my argument is simply that when you look at the conduct that comprises the offense in this particular case, and you compare it to the conduct in other types of circumstances where there was false swearing, that an 18-month suspension is an appropriate recommendation under the circumstances. My argument is simply that whether or not the conduct is described in the criminal law as a misdemeanor or a felony should not control and has never controlled this court's discretion and analysis. Let's look at Walz. Walz was a case in which you said it is appropriate when there is a conviction for a felony, which in my opinion, and I read that case, it seems like dictum, but let's assume that that's the opinion of the court. Walz is a totally different circumstance. In Walz, you had a crime of violence in which the person, in which the attorney refused to concede that and accept responsibility for that act of violence. Secondly, not only did the attorney refuse to accept responsibility, tried to claim that they didn't commit the act later on, and the record showed that at the time of the hearing before the attorney was suffering from depression and probably was not mentally in a state that they should continue to practice law. And this court said that in that particular case, it was necessary because of the gravity of that type of criminal activity that it was necessary to deter members of the bar from committing acts of violence that attorney be disbarred. But that's not necessarily what this case is. And I suspect that there will be cases that will come before this court in the future, given the highly regulated, as Harvey Silvergate has said in his book, Three Felonies a Day, society that we live in which there will be attorneys that will be subject to discipline for federal regulatory felonies that on their face are felonies, but perhaps on close examination and consideration of all the factors, both mitigating and otherwise, related to the conduct, that really the conduct itself does not implicate a situation in which the attorney should not be allowed to continue practicing law, even though subject to some sort of disciplinary sanction. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have any time for rebuttals?
3 minutes and 8 seconds to say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will go on to the next case of the day.